panic ripping his heart, thoughts of a big story forgotten. A dark opening appeared at the side of the tunnel, and Duffy made for it. Smithback followed, and suddenly the ground opened up beneath his feet. In an instant, he was sliding uncontrollably down a slick, wet chute. Duffy's wail came keening up from below as Smithback spun around, clawing at the slick surface. It was like every dream he'd ever had of falling, except even more horrible, inside a dank, black tunnel, unguessable depths beneath Manhattan. Suddenly, there was a splash in front of him, and the next moment he, too, landed, hard, in about 20 inches of water. He scrambled to his feet, aching in numerous places, but glad to feel a firm surface under his feet. The floor of the tunnel seemed even, and the water smelled relatively fresh. Beside him, Duffy was wailing uncontrollably.
"Shut up!" Smithback hissed at him. "You're gonna draw those things right to us!"
"Oh, my God!" Duffy sobbed in the darkness. This can't be happening! Dan, what are they? What?"
Smithback reached into the blackness, located Duffy's arm, and pulled the man toward him brusquely.
"Shut up!"
he said, lips touching the engineer's ear. The sobbing subsided to a soft hiccuping.
"Where's the flashlight?"
Smithback whispered. Sobbing was the only reply, but then a dim light switched on nearby. Miraculously, Duffy was still clutching it.
"Where are we?"
The hiccuping subsided.
"Duffy, where are we?"
There was a stifled sob.
"I don't know. One of the spillover tubes, maybe."
"Any idea where it goes?"
There was a sniffle.
"It bleeds off excess flow from the reservoir. If we move downstream the bottleneck, maybe we can reach the lower drain system."
"And from there, how do we get out?"
Smithback whispered. Duffy hiccuped.
"I don't know."
Smithback mopped his face again and said nothing, trying to roll the fear, the pain, and the shock into a little ball he could stuff down inside himself. He tried to think about his story. God, he'd be a made man with a story like this, following on the heels of the museum beast murders. And with luck, he'd still have the Wisher piece in his pocket. But first... There was a splashing sound, its distance hard to gauge because of the echoes, but clearly approaching. He leaned into the darkness, straining to hear.
"They're still after us!"
Duffy yelped, inches from his eardrum. Smithback grabbed the arm a second time.
"Duffy, shut up and listen to me. We can't outrun them. We need to lose them. You know the system. You've got to tell me how."
Duffy struggled, making an unintelligible sound of fear. Smithback squeezed harder.
"Look, we're going to be all right if you just calm down and think."
Duffy seemed to relax, and Smithback could hear him breathing heavily.
"All right,"
the engineer said.
"The emergency spillovers have gauging stations at the bottom, just before the bottleneck. If that's where we are... maybe we can hide inside.
Let's go,"
Smithback hissed. They splashed through the darkness, the flashlight beam jogging from wall to wall. The low tunnel took a turn, and a vast, ancient piece of machinery rose up before Smithback, a giant hollow screw or something like it, placed horizontally on a bed of granite. Heavily rusted pipes protruded from either end, and a convoluted mass of pipes lay farther back, like coiled iron guts. At the base of the machine was a small, railed platform. The main body of the stream ran down past the station, while a small side tunnel snaked its way into the blackness to their left. Taking the flashlight, Smithback grabbed the railing and swung himself up, then helped Duffy to a position beside him.
"Into the pipe,"
Smithback whispered. He pushed Duffy inside, then wriggled in himself, tossing the lighted flashlight into the stream before retreating into the darkness.
"Are you crazy? You just threw away..."
"It's plastic," Smithback said. "It'll float. I'm hoping they'll follow the light downstream."
They sat in absolute silence. The thick walls of the gauging machinery muffled the tunnel noise, but in a few minutes, Smithback could tell that the splashing sounds had grown more distinct. The wrinklers were approaching, swiftly, too, by the sound. Behind him, he could feel Duffy twitch, and he prayed the engineer would keep his head. The splashing became louder, and now Smithback could hear them breathing, a heavy wheezing like a winded horse. The splashing sounds drew alongside the gauging station, then stopped. The foul, goatish reek was thick now, and Smithback shut his eyes tightly. In the blackness to his rear, Duffy was trembling violently. He heard splashes in the water outside the station as the things milled about. There was a low noise that sounded like snuffling, and Smithback froze, remembering the Umbwan beast's keen sense of smell. The splashing continued. Then, with an enormous feeling of relief, Smithback heard it begin to retreat. The things were continuing down the tunnel. He breathed slowly and deeply, counting each breath. At 30, he turned to Duffy.
Which way to the storm trains?
Out the far end,
Duffy whispered. Let's go. Carefully, they turned around within the cramped, fetid space and began wriggling their way toward the rear of the pipe. Duffy emerged at last into the open air. Smithback heard first one, then both of the engineer's feet drop into the water, and was wriggling forward himself when a sudden, piercing scream cut through the pitch black, and a spray too thick and warm to be water spattered his face. He backed frantically into the pipe.
Help!
Duffy blurted suddenly.
No, please don't! You're gonna... Oh, God! That's my guts! Jesus! Somebody get...
The voice changed suddenly to a frenzied, wet wheeze, then died beneath the heavy thrashing of water. Smithback, scrambling backwards in mindless terror, heard a thudding sound like meat chopped with a cleaver, followed by the knuckle crack of bones being wrenched from their sockets. Smithback fell out the near end of the pipe, landed on his back in the stream, scrambled to his feet, and ran blindly down the side tunnel, not hearing, not caring, not thinking about anything except running. He ran and ran, careening off the sides of the tunnel, scrabbling and thrashing down the endlessly forking paths, deeper and deeper into the dark bowels of the earth. The tunnel joined another and another, each one larger than the last, until, quite suddenly, he felt an arm, wet and horribly strong, slide around his neck and a powerful hand clamp down simultaneously over his mouth. 55. Within an hour of its spontaneous flare-up, the riot along Central Park South had begun to sputter fitfully. Well before 11 p.m., most of the initial rioters had spent their anger along with their energy. Those who had been hurt were helped to the sidelines. Shouting, insults, and threats began to replace fists, clubs, and stones. However, a hard central core of violence continued. As people left the scene, bruised or exhausted, others arrived. Some curious, some angry, some drunk and spoiling for a fight. Television reports waxed lurid and hysterical. Word traveled like an electric spark through the island, up First and Second Avenues, where young Republicans gathered in singles bars to jeer and hoot at the liberal president, along St. Mark's Place and into the Marxist corners of the East Village, over fax lines and telephone lines. As word spread, so did the rumors. Some said that the homeless and those that tried to help them were being massacred in a police-instigated genocide. Others said that leftist radicals and criminal mobs were burning banks, shooting citizens, and looting businesses uptown. Those that answered this call to action ran into, sometimes brutally, the last pockets of homeless that were still streaming to the surface, emerging here and there around Central Park, fleeing the trapped and spreading tear gas. The original vanguard of Take Back Our City, the Brahmins of New York wealth and influence, had quickly retreated from the scene. Most had returned to their townhouses and duplexes in dismay. Others had massed toward the Great Lawn, assuming the police would quickly quell the rioting and hoping that the final vigil would go on as planned. But as the police shored up their line and began to hem in the rioters, the fighting itself also retreated deeper into the park, moving ever closer to the lawn and the reservoir that lay beyond. The darkness of the park, the thick woods, the tangle of undergrowth, and the maze of paths all made efforts at riot control difficult and slow. The police moved against the rioters with caution. Already spread too thin by the massive rousting operation, much of the force was late on the scene of the riot. The police brass was all too keenly aware that influential people might still be among the milling throng, and the idea of gassing or clubbing a member of the New York elite was not something the politically conscious commissioner would allow. In addition, a large body of officers had to be dispatched to patrol the adjoining areas of the city, where sporadic looting and vandalism were now being reported. And in the backs of everyone's minds lay the unspoken but dreaded spectacle of the Crown Heights riot of a few years before, which had gone on for 3 days before finally drawing to an uneasy close. Hayward watched as the emergency medical crew rolled Beale into the waiting ambulance. The back legs of the stretcher folded up as the officer was slid inside. Beale groaned, then raised a hand toward his bandaged head.
Careful,
Hayward snapped to the paramedic. She put a hand on one of the rear doors and leaned inside.
How you doing?
She asked.
Been better,
Beale said with a weak smile. Hayward nodded.
You'll be fine.
She turned to go.
Sergeant?
Beale said. Hayward paused.
That bastard Miller would have left me there to find my own way out. I drown, maybe. I think I owe you guys my life.
Forget it, Hayward said. It's part of the job, right?
Maybe, Beale said. But anyway, I won't forget. Thanks.
Hayward left Beale with the paramedic and walked around to the driver's seat. What's the news? She asked.
What do you want to hear? The driver asked, scribbling on a log sheet. Gold futures? The international situation? Take your act to the Poconos, she replied. I'm talking about this.
And she waved her hand along Central Park West. A surreal quiet lay over the dark scene. Except for emergency vehicles and the police cars stationed at every other cross street, there was no traffic on the immediate blocks. Pools of darkness dotted the avenue. A mere handful of streetlights remained unbroken, sizzling and sputtering. The broad avenue was dotted with chunks of concrete, broken glass, and trash. Farther to the south, Hayward noticed, the flashing lights grew much more numerous.
"Where you been?" the driver asked. Unless you spent the last hour at the center of the earth, it was pretty hard to miss the action around here.
You're not that far wrong, she said. We've been clearing out the homeless underneath the park. There was resistance. This guy got wounded, and it took us a long time to extract him. We were pretty deep underground, and we didn't want to jostle him too much. Okay? We came up 5 minutes ago at the 72nd Street station, only to find a ghost town around here.
Clearing out the homeless? The driver asked. So you're the one responsible.
Hayward frowned.
For what?
The ambulance driver tapped his ear, then pointed eastward as if that was the only answer necessary. Hayward stopped to listen. Over the squawk of the ambulance scanner and the distant pulse of the city, she could make out sounds floating from the dark interior of Central Park. The angry buzz of bullhorns, shouts, screams, a whine of sirens.
You know that Take Back Our City march? The driver asked. The unannounced one that was going along Central Park South?
Heard something about it. Hayward said.
Yeah? Well, suddenly, all these homeless started pouring up from underground. Kind of hostile, too. Apparently, you cops had been using them for baton practice. Started squabbling with the marchers. Before you know it, there was a full-blown confrontation. People just went nuts, I heard. Screaming, yelling, stomping on other people. Then the looting started up along the fringes. Took the cops an hour to get the situation under control. It still isn't under control, actually, but they've managed to confine everything to the park.
The paramedic in the rear gave a signal, and the driver put the ambulance in gear and pulled away, flashing lights striping the limestone facades. Farther up Central Park West, Hayward could see curious people looking out from their windows, pointing into the park. A few braver souls were standing on the pavement outside of lobbies, staying close to the protective presence of uniformed doormen. She gazed up at the huge, Gothic shape of the Dakota, unharmed and seemingly aloof from the chaos, almost as if its narrow, stylized moat had repulsed an angry throng. She found her eyes traveling up the corner tower toward what must be Pendergast's windows. She wondered if he'd made it back from the Devil's Attic in one piece.
"Get Beale off, okay?"
she heard Carlin call out. His massive form emerged out of the distant shadows.
"Just now," she replied, turning toward him. "How about the other one?"
"Refuse medical treatment," Carlin said. "Any sign of Miller?"
Hayward scowled. He's probably in some Atlantic Avenue bar by now, sucking down beer and bragging about his exploits. That's how it works, right? He'll get a promotion, and we'll get letters of caution for insubordination.
Maybe other times it works that way, Carlin said with a knowing smile. But not this time.
What's that supposed to mean? Hayward asked, then continued without giving Carlin time to answer. No way to tell what Miller did or didn't do. Guess we'd better report in. She grabbed out a radio, snapping it on, but torrents of noise, static, and panic came pouring from every band.
Moving toward the Great Lawn. We need more manpower to in...
Got 8 of them here, but I can't hold them much longer. If that wagon doesn't come here soon, they'll just melt away into the dark.
I called for a medevac 30 goddamn minutes ago. We got people hurt up here.
Christ, they gotta seal that southern quadrant. More keep coming in all the time.
Hayward snapped the radio off and snugged it back into her belt, then motioned Carlin to follow her down to the squad car at the next corner. A police officer in riot gear stood beside it, vigilantly scanning the street, shotgun in hand.
"Where's command for this operation?" Hayward asked.
The policeman tipped up his face shield and looked at her.
"There's a forward command post in the castle," he said. "That's what dispatch says, anyway. Things are kind of disorganized right now, as if you couldn't tell."
"Belvedere Castle."
Hayward turned toward Carlin. "We better head for it." As they ran down Central Park West, Hayward was strangely reminded of her visit to a Hollywood backlot 2 years before.
She remembered walking down the ersatz Manhattan street on which countless musicals and gangster films had been shot. She'd seen phony street lamps, shop fronts, fire hydrants, everything but people. At the time, common sense had told her that a mere 100 yards away were bustling, vibrant California streets. Yet the still emptiness of the lot had seemed almost spectral. Tonight, Central Park West felt the same way. Though she could hear the distant honking of car horns and the whistle of sirens, and though she knew that within the park itself police were massing to stop the rioting and confusion, this darkened avenue seemed ghostly and unreal. Only the occasional vigilant doorman, curious resident, or police checkpoint broke the atmosphere of a ghost street.
"Holy shit," Carlin muttered at her side. "Would you look at that?"
Hayward glanced up, and her reverie instantly dissolved. It was like crossing a demilitarized zone from order into chaos. To the south, across 65th Street, they saw a sea of ruin. Lobby windows were smashed, awnings over elegant entrances were torn to shreds and flapping idly in the breeze. The police presence here was stronger, the blue-painted barricades omnipresent. Cars along the curbs were missing windows and windshields. A few blocks down, a police tow truck with flashing yellow lights was removing the smoking skeleton of a taxi. "Looks like some pretty pissed-off mole people came through here," Hayward murmured. They cut across the street, angling toward the drive and heading into the park. After the destruction they'd just passed, the narrow asphalt path seemed quiet and deserted, but the smashed benches, overturned trash cans, and smoldering garbage bore mute testimony to what had taken place here not long before. And the noise that drifted toward them from the interior of the park gave promise of even greater pandemonium to come. Suddenly Hayward stopped short, motioning Carlin to do the same. Ahead in the dark she could make out a group of people, how many she could not be certain, swaggering in the direction of the great lawn. "Can't be cops," she thought. "They're not wearing riot helmets or even hats." A noisy burst of hooting and cursing from the group confirmed her suspicion. She moved forward quickly, running on the balls of her feet to minimize noise. At 10 yards back, she stopped.
"Halt,"
she said, hand on her service piece.
"Police officers!"
The group came to a ragged stop, then turned back to look at her. Five men, youngish, dressed in sports jackets and polo shirts. Her eyes took in the visible weapons, 2 aluminum bats and what looked like a kitchen carving knife. They stared at her, faces flushed, grins still on their youthful faces.
"Yeah?"
one of them said, taking a step forward.
"Stop right there,"
Hayward said. The man stopped. "Now why don't you boys tell me exactly where you're headed?" The man in front scoffed at the stupidity of the question, indicating the interior of the park with the merest jerk of his head.
"We're here to take care of business,"
came a voice from the group. Hayward shook her head.
"What's going on there is none of your business." "The hell it isn't,"
the one in front snapped.
"We got friends there getting the shit beat out of them by a bunch of goddamn bums. There's no way we're going to let that go on."
He took another step forward.
"This is a police matter," Hayward said. "The police haven't done jack shit," the man replied. "Look around. You've let this scum trash our city." "We heard they killed 20-30 people already,"
came the slurred voice of a man holding up a cellular phone.
"Including Mrs. Wisher. They're trashing the city. They got bastards from the East Village in Soho to help them out. Goddamn NYU activists. Our friends need help."
"Got that?" said the one in front. "So get out of the way, lady." He took another step forward. "You take another step, and I'll part your hair with this," Hayward said, slipping her hand from her gun to her baton and sliding it smoothly from the belt ring. She felt Carlin tense beside her.
"Pretty easy for you to talk tough," the man said scornfully, "with a gun on your belt and a goddamn human refrigerator at your side." "Think you can take all 5 of us?"
said someone in the group.
"Maybe she thinks she can smother us all to death with those jugs of hers," said another.
Several grins broke out. Hayward took a deep breath, then replaced her baton. "Officer Carlin," she said, "please take 20 steps back." Carlin remained motionless.
"Do it!"
she snapped. Carlin stared at her for a moment. Then, without turning or taking his eyes from the group, he began walking backward down the path they had come. Hayward stepped deliberately up to the lead youth.
"Now listen up," she said evenly, without taking her eyes off his. "I could take off my badge and my piece and still kick all your sorry white bread asses back to Scarsdale or Greenwich or wherever it is your mothers tuck you in at night. But I don't need to do that. See, if you refuse to follow my instructions to the letter, then your mothers won't be tucking you in this evening.
They'll be waiting in line at Police Plaza tomorrow morning to make your bails, and all the money or power or influence in the world won't be able to remove the words intent to commit felonious assault from your police record. In this state, a person convicted of a felony can never practice law. They can never hold public office, and they can never get a license to trade securities. And your daddies aren't going to like that, not one bit. She paused a moment.
So drop your weapons, she said coolly. There was a brief instant in which nobody moved.
I said drop your weapons,
she yelled at the top of her voice. In the silence that followed, she heard the clink of an aluminum bat hitting asphalt, then another. Then came a quieter sound, a steel blade dropping to the earth. She waited a long moment, then took a deliberate step backward. Officer Carlin, Hayward said quietly. In a moment he was at her side.
Shall I frisk them? He asked.
Hayward shook her head. Driver's licenses, she said to the group. I want those too. Drop them on the ground right there. There was a brief pause, then the youth in front dug a hand into his jacket pocket, removed his wallet, and let the plastic card flutter to the ground. The rest followed suit. You can pick them up tomorrow afternoon at One Police Plaza, she continued. Ask for Sergeant Hayward. Now I want you all to walk straight past me until you reach Central Park West. Then I want you to go your separate ways. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Head straight home and go to bed. Understand? There was another silence.
I can't hear you,
Carlin's voice roared out, and the men jumped.
We understand, came the chorused response.
Then move out, Hayward said. The youths stood motionless, as if rooted to the spot.
Shake it!
She barked. The group started up, silently, head straight ahead, walking slowly at first, then faster towards the west. Soon they had vanished into the darkness.
Bunch of pricks, said Carlin. You think 20 or 30 were really killed?
Hayward snorted as she bent to pick up the weapons and licenses.
Hell no. But if the rumors keep spreading, people like that are going to keep coming, and this situation will never get resolved.
She handed him the bats with a sigh.
Come on. We might as well report in and see if we can help out tonight, because tomorrow you know we're going to get our butts reprimanded for what happened down in those tunnels.
Not this time, Carlin replied, grinning slightly.
You said that before. Hayward turned toward him. Just what are you telling me, Carlin?
I'm telling you that this time the righteous shall be rewarded, and it's the Millers of the world who will get hung out to dry.
And just when did you acquire this gift of prophecy?
When I learned that our friend Beale, who you helped into the ambulance back there, is the son of one Stephen X. Beale.
Stephen Beale, the state senator? Hayward asked, eyes widening.
Carlin nodded.
He doesn't like people to know, he said. Afraid people will think he's pulling influence to get an easy ride or something. But that crack on his head must have loosened his tongue a bit.
Hayward stood motionless a moment. Then, shaking her head, she turned back in the direction of the great lawn.
Sergeant?
Carlin asked.
Yes?
Why did you ask me to step away from those punks like that?
Hayward paused.
I wanted to show them that I wasn't afraid, and that I meant business.
Would you have?
Would I have what?
You know, Carlin gestured. Kicked their asses back to Scarsdale and all that?
Hayward looked at him, raising her chin slightly.
What do you think?
I think, Carlin hesitated a moment, I think you're one scary lady, Miss Hayward.
56. As the launch sliced through the dark waters of the Hudson River, snow suited up below decks, feeling the hull tremble with the muffled rumble of the big twin diesels. There was barely enough room to stand amongst the LORAN gear, geo-positioning satellite units, sonar equipment, and arms lockers. He noted that it was a wetsuit, not the usual sealed dry suit the police team wore, and instantly regretted his suggestion to go in through the treatment plant.
Too late,
he thought, struggling with the suit. The boat lurched, and he pitched forward, banging his head painfully against a bulkhead. He rubbed his forehead with a curse.
It hurt, all right. So he wasn't dreaming.
He really was in a boat full of Navy SEALs, armed to the teeth, bound for God only knew what kind of mission. Fear and excitement surged through him simultaneously. This, he knew, meant a chance at redemption. Maybe his only chance. He'd make damn sure he didn't screw it up. He adjusted the lantern visor, snugged on the last glove, and went topside. Commander Racklin, who had gone forward and was speaking with the coxswain, turned at his approach.
Where the hell's your paint, and what took you?
The equipment is a little different from what I'm used to, sir.
Well, you got from now until insertion to get used to it.
Yes, sir.
Racklin jerked his head towards Snow.
Donovan, get him fixed up.
Donovan came over and wordlessly began smearing black and green grease paint across Snow's cheeks and forehead. Racklin motioned the rest of the team to gather round.
Now listen up, he said, unrolling a plastic map on one thigh. We're going in via the main settling tank above the west side lateral. According to Snow here, it's the quickest way in.
His finger traced a route on the map.
Once at the first riser, we'll follow our plotted course until we reach this place here where the tunnels branch. That's a rally point. Once we're in position, teams Alpha, Beta, and Gamma will each take one of these tunnels. I'll lead Alpha and ride point. Snow and Donovan are Team Delta. They catch the milk run, staying in the rear and covering our asses. Questions?
Snow had several, but he decided against asking any of them. His face burned from the rough strokes of Donovan's gloved hand, and the thick grease paint smelled like rancid tallow. The commander nodded.
We'll go in, place the charges, and come out. Nice and simple, just like exercises at the FIB base. The charges will seal off the lower drainage tunnels that feed into the lateral. Another team is going down from the street, sealing access from above. Real pros from the sound of it.
The commander made a snorting sound through his mask.
They told us to use NVDs, if you can believe that.
NVDs? Snow echoed.
Night vision devices, darling. But try wearing one over a wetsuit and mask.
He spat over the side.
We're not afraid of the dark, and anything that wants to come take a piece of us, let 'em try. Still, I like to see when I'm blown away.
He stepped forward.
All right, Hastings, Clapham, Beecham, you catch AW duty this mission. I want one weapons carrier per team. Lorenzo, Campion, Donovan, carry the pyros. You'll be the candy man along with myself. We've got redundant charges, so expect a heavy load. Now shoulder up.
Snow watched as the men slung automatic weapons over their shoulders.
But what about me? He heard himself asking.
Racklin turned toward him.
I don't know. What about you?
Snow paused.
I'd like to do something. To help, I mean.
Racklin stared at him for a moment, then a small smile appeared briefly on his lips.
Okay, he said. You get to be Chunk Boy for this op.
Chunk Boy? Snow asked.
Chunk Boy.
The commander nodded.
Beecham! Toss the kid over here!
Racklin caught the waterproof rubber duffel that was thrown to him, then placed it over Snow's neck.
That stays on until we reach the exit point, he muttered.
I'll need a weapon, sir, Snow said.
Get him something.
Somebody thrust the butt of a harpoon gun into Snow's gut, and he quickly looped the strap over his shoulder. He thought he heard somebody sniggering quietly, but he ignored it. Snow had speared plenty of fish in the Sea of Cortez, but he'd never seen spears quite as long or as evil-looking as the ones that hung from the underbelly of this gun, fat, explosive charges packed at their ends.
"Don't shoot any crocodiles," Donovan said. "They're endangered."
It was the first time he'd spoken. The throb of the engines grew deeper, and the boat eased up to a cement landing beneath the dark outline of the lower Hudson sewage treatment plant. Snow looked up at the enormous concrete structure with a sinking feeling. It was fully automated, supposedly state-of-the-art, but he'd heard the facility had been nothing but problems since going online almost 5 years before. He hoped to God he was right about going in through the main settling tanks.
"Think we ought to alert him that we're coming?" Snow asked.
Racklin looked at him, faint amusement on his face.
"Way ahead of you. Took care of things while you were below decks. They'll be expecting us."
A Jacob's ladder was thrown over the side, and the men quickly scrambled down to the landing. Snow looked around, orienting himself. He recognized the area from the basic tour. The control room was not far off. The team followed him up a metal staircase, then past a large array of aeration and settling tanks. The smell of methane and sewage hung in the air like a mephitic fog. At the far end of the tanks, Snow stopped at a metal door, bright yellow against the monotonous gray of the facility, with painted red letters, "Do not open door. Alarm will sound." Racklin brushed Snow aside and kicked the door open, revealing a spare cement corridor blazing with white fluorescent light. A siren began, low and insistent.
"Move out," Racklin said quietly.
Snow led them up a double flight of stairs and onto a landing marked Control. There was a set of doors on the landing with a carded entry system set into the wall beside them. The commander stood back, preparing to kick in the doors again. Then, reconsidering, he moved forward and nudged one with his hand. It swung open, unlocked. Beyond was a vast room, flooded with light and full of the odor of treated sewage. Monitoring equipment and regulators lined the walls. In the center, a lone supervisor sat at the control station. He hung up the phone on his desk, his hair disheveled, blinking as if the telephone had roused him out of a sound sleep.
"Do you know who that was?" he exclaimed, pointing at the phone. "Holy God, that was the deputy director of the..."
"Good," Racklin replied. "Then I won't have to waste any time. We need you to shut down the main outflow propeller right now."
The man blinked at Racklin as if seeing him for the first time. Then his gaze traveled down the line of seals, growing more wide-eyed as he went.
"Damn," he said, almost reverently, staring at Snow's harpoon gun. "He wasn't kidding, was he?"
"Hurry up now, darling," Racklin drawled, "or we'll throw you in the tank and let your fat old carcass shut it down for us."
The man jumped to his feet, trotted over to a panel, and flipped several levers.
5 minutes is the most I can spare," he said over his shoulder as he moved toward another bank of controls. "Any longer and everything west of Lenox Avenue will back up."
5 minutes is all we'll need," Racklin looked at his watch. "Get us to the settling tank."
Panting softly, the supervisor led the team back out to the landing, down one flight, and along a narrow corridor. At the far end, he opened a small access door and descended a spiral staircase of painted red metal. The staircase opened onto a small walkway that hung suspended a few feet above a foamy, roiling surface.
"You really going down in that?" the man asked, looking them over once again with the same expression of disbelief on his jowled face.
Snow looked down at the foamy, scum-laden surface, nose wrinkling involuntarily, regretting he'd been in the office that evening, and deeply regretting that he'd suggested this as an entry point.
"First the humbled kill, and now..."
"That's in affirmative," the commander replied. The man licked his lips.
"You'll find the main feeder 5 feet below the surface on the east side of the tank," he said.
"Watch out for the propeller valve. I've turned it off, but the residual flow will still be turning the blades." Racklin nodded and turned to Snow.
"And the first riser is where exactly?"
320 feet down the feeder," the supervisor said. "Keep to your left as the pipes divide."
"That's all we need to know," Racklin said. "Get on upstairs now and fire everything back up as soon as you get there."
The man paused, still staring at the group.
"Move!"
Racklin barked, and the man scampered up the staircase. Snow went first, falling backwards into the bubbling vat, followed by Donovan. When he gingerly opened his eyes, he was surprised at how clear the effluent was. Thin, not treacly, and with the faintest milky cast. The others jumped in. He could feel the wetness creeping against his skin and tried not to think about it. Snow swam forward against the slight current. Ahead, he could see the stalled propellers of the outflow valve blocking the circular pipe beyond, the steel blades still turning slowly. He stopped and let Racklin and the other two teams catch up, until the seven seals were all hanging suspended beside them. Racklin pointed to Snow, then made an exaggerated count with his fingers. At three, Snow and Donovan darted through the propellers. Alpha Team was next, then Beta, then Gamma. Snow found himself within a massive stainless steel pipe, leading on into vast, dark depths. The same creeping terror he'd felt in the mud of Humboldt Kill threatened to bubble once again to the surface, but he fought it back, slowing his breathing, mentally counting his heartbeats. No panic, not this time. Racklin and his partner swam through the blades, then Racklin made a sharp gesture to Snow to continue. He quickly moved ahead, leading the other teams down the tunnel. Behind him, Snow heard the whine of a turbine, and the propeller began to pick up speed. The current around him quickened noticeably. No going back now, even if he wanted to. The tunnel angled downward, forking once, then twice. Snow kept to the left each time. After what seemed like an eternity of swimming, the squad stopped at last beside the first vent riser, a narrow steel shaft barely wider than his shoulders. Racklin indicated that he would take the lead from here. Following the seals, Snow swam downwards, awash in bubbles from the preceding air tanks. After several yards, the commander stopped the descent, then led them into a horizontal tube even narrower than the riser. Snow squeezed in behind Donovan, breathing hard as his tanks bounced from wall to wall in time to the motion of his swimming. Suddenly, gleaming steel gave way to old iron pipe, covered with a spongy coating of rust. The passage of the previous divers swirled the effluent in opaque orange against Snow's mask. He struggled forward, feeling the reassuring turbulence from Donovan's unseen fins. They stopped briefly while Racklin consulted his map with the aid of a submersible penlight. Then two more bends, another short rise, and Snow felt the surface of the water break around his head. They were in a huge, ancient passageway, perhaps 16 feet in diameter and full to half its depth in sluggishly flowing liquid, the main lateral.
"Snow and Donovan to the rear," came the muffled voice of Racklin. "Stay on the surface, but keep breathing tank air. This atmosphere is likely to be loaded with methane. Proceed in standard formation."
The commander quickly consulted a plastic map hooked to his suit and then started forward. The group spread out, swimming along the surface, tracing a circuitous route through the system of pipes. Snow prided himself on his ability as a distance swimmer, but he felt distinctly outclassed by the seven men moving easily through the water ahead of him. The passageway opened at last into a large pentagonal chamber, yellow stalactites dripping water from the vaulted ceiling. Snow stared with amazement at a massive iron chain hanging from a massive metal eye cleat set in the vault's apex. A trickle of water ran down the chain, off a great rusted hook at its end, and dribbled into the pool. There was a cement landing streaked with rust. Three large, dry tunnels branched off from the walls of the chamber.
3 points, Racklin said. We'll use this as our rally base. The op should be a cakewalk, but we'll do it by the book. Follow strict challenge and reply procedures. Proper response will be 3 even numbers. The rules of engagement are simple. Identify yourself, but shoot to kill any threat or hindrance to your work. Extraction point will be the 125th Street Canal.
The commander looked around.
All right, gentlemen, let's earn our MREs.
57. For a dreadful moment, Margot thought they were under attack, and she turned instinctively, raising her weapon to the ready position, strangely reluctant to look at the thing Pendergast was struggling with. There was a whispered curse from Dagosta. Squinting through the still unfamiliar goggles, Margot realized Pendergast was grappling with a person, perhaps a homeless man who had evaded the police roust. He certainly looked the part, wet, caked in mud, apparently bleeding from some unseen wound.
"Shut off his light!"
Pendergast hissed. The flashlight beam struck her goggles, then winked out. The glowing vista seesawed violently as her goggles tried to compensate, coming back into focus as they stabilized. She drew her breath in sharply. There was something about the lanky features, the tousled hair, that was irresistibly familiar.
"Bill?"
she asked in disbelief. Pendergast had the man on the ground, hugging him almost protectively, murmuring words into one ear. After a moment, the man stopped struggling and went limp. Pendergast released him gently and stood up. Margot leaned in for a closer look. It was Smith back, all right.
"Give him a minute,"
Pendergast said.
"I don't believe it," the ghost growled. "What, you think he followed us down here?"
Pendergast shook his head.
"No, nobody followed us."
He looked around at the confluence of tunnels above and below.
"This is the bottleneck, where all descending tunnels of the Central Park Quadrant meet. He was being chased, apparently, and his path intersected ours. The question is, chased by who or what?"
He unshipped his flamethrower and glanced at Dagosta.
"You'd better be ready with the flash, Vincent."
Suddenly, Smithback lunged upwards, then fell back onto the mass of pipes and 24-inch mains that made up the floor of the bottleneck.
"They killed Duffy!"
he cried.
"Who are you? Help me, I can't see!"
Pocketing her weapon, Margot came forward and knelt at his side. The trip down from the subway tunnel, through noisome corridors and dark, echoing galleries that seemed incredibly out of place dozens of stories beneath Manhattan, had been like an endless, dark dream. Seeing her friend race out of the darkness, petrified with fear and shock, only increased her sense of unreality.
"Bill," she said soothingly, "it's okay. It's Margot. Please, keep quiet. We don't dare use lights, and there isn't a spare set of goggles, but we'll help you along."
Smithback blinked in her direction, pupils wide.
"I want to get out of here,"
he cried suddenly, struggling to his feet.
"What?"
the ghost said sarcastically.
"And miss your story?"
"You can't go back alone,"
Pendergast said, putting a restraining arm on his shoulder. The struggle seemed to have exhausted Smithback, and he sagged forward.
"What are you doing here?" he asked at last.
"I might ask you the same question," Pendergast replied.
"Mephisto was leading us to the Astor Tunnels. The devil's attic. There was a plan to drain the reservoir and flood the creatures out."
"Captain Waxy's plan," Dagosta added.
"But the reservoir's full of the Umbun Lily. That's where the creatures were growing it, and we can't allow the plants to reach the open ocean.
It's too late to stop the water dump, so a SEAL team was sent in from the river to seal the lowest spillway tunnels below. We're going to seal off the spaces above the Astor tunnels to prevent any spillages. We'll bottle up the flow, keep it from escaping down into the river. If we succeed, it'll back up the bottleneck here, but nowhere else. Smithback remained unspeaking, his head bowed.
We're well armed and fully prepared for whatever's down there. We have maps. You'll be safer with us. Do you understand, William?
Margot watched as Pendergast's mellifluous delivery worked its calming effect. Smithback's breathing seemed to slow, and finally he nodded almost imperceptibly.
So what were you up to anyway? The ghost asked.
Pendergast made a restraining motion with one hand, but Smithback looked in the direction of the lieutenant.
I followed Captain Waxy and a group of policemen underneath the reservoir, he said quietly. They were trying to shut off some valves, but they'd been sabotaged or something. Then...
He stopped abruptly.
And they came.
Bill, don't, Margot interjected.
I ran away, Smithback said, swallowing hard. Duffy and I ran away, but they caught him in the gauging station. They...
That's enough, said Pendergast quietly. There was a silence. Sabotage, did you say? Smithback nodded.
I heard Duffy say that somebody had been messing with the valves.
That is troublesome. Troublesome indeed. There was a look on Pendergast's face that Margot had not seen before. We'd better continue, he said, shouldering the flamethrower again. This bottleneck is a perfect place for an ambush. He glanced around the dark tunnel.
Mephisto,
he whispered. There was a stirring in the darkness, then Mephisto came forward, arms folded across his chest, a wide smirk on his whiskered lips.
I was just enjoying this touching reunion, he said in his silky hiss. Now the merry band of adventurers is complete. Ho, Scriblerian, I see you've descended farther than you dared venture on our first meeting. Grows on you, doesn't it?
Not especially, Smithback replied in a low voice.
How nice, at least, to have one's own Boswell at hand.
In the artificial light of the goggles, it seemed to Margot that Mephisto's eyes glittered gold and crimson as they surveyed the group.
Will you compose an epic poem on the event? The Mephistiad. In heroic couplets, please. That's assuming you live to tell the tale. I wonder which of us will survive, and which will leave their whitened bones to lie here forever in the tunnels beneath Manhattan.
Let's move on, Pendergast said.
I see. Whitey here feels there has been enough talk. Perhaps he fears it will be his bones left to the rats.
We need to set several series of charges directly below the bottleneck, Pendergast said smoothly. If we stand here listening to your empty posturing, we won't have time to exit before the reservoir dumps. Then it will be your bones as well as mine that are left for the rats.
Very well, Mephisto said. Don't chafe.
He turned and began clambering down a large, dark tube.
No,
Smithback said. The Ghosta took a step toward the journalist.
Come on, I'll take your hand.
The vertical tube ended in a high-ceiling tunnel, and they waited in the darkness while Pendergast set several sets of charges, then motioned them on. A few hundred yards down the tunnel, they arrived at a walkway that crossed a few feet above the level of the water. Margot felt grateful. The ankle-deep stream had been cold and foul.
Well, whispered Mephisto, climbing on the walkway, perhaps the mayor of Grant's tomb can finally dry out his wingtips. Perhaps the hobo king can finally shut up, the ghost growled.
A delighted hiss came from Mephisto.
Ha! Hobo king! Charming! Perhaps I should go hunting track rabbits and leave you to do your own spelunking.
The ghost stiffened, but held his tongue, and Mephisto led the way across the walkway into a crawl space beyond. Margot heard the roar of falling water in the distance, and soon the passage ended at a narrow waterfall. A narrow iron ladder, almost concealed by the ordure of many decades, descended into a vertical tunnel at the base of the falls. They passed through the tunnel one at a time, dropping to an irregular bedrock floor beneath the confluence of two 72-inch mains. The narrow boreholes of explosive drills lined the walls like the work of disorderly termites.
Nous sommes arrivés, said Mephisto,
and for the first time Margot thought she could detect nervousness behind the bluster.
The devil's attic is directly beneath us.
Motioning them to stay put, Pendergast checked his maps and then vanished noiselessly into the ancient tunnel. As the seconds turned to minutes, Margot found herself ready to jump at every drop of water from the mossy ceiling, at every stifled sneeze or restless stirring. Once again, she questioned her own motives for coming along. It was becoming increasingly hard to ignore the fact that she was hundreds of feet underground, in an obscure and long-forgotten warren of service passageways, railroad tunnels, and other spaces even more obscure, with a lurking foe that at any moment might... There was a movement in the dark beside her.
"Dear Dr. Green," came the silky hiss of Mephisto, "I'm sorry you decided to join our little walkabout, but since you're here, maybe you can do me a favor. Please understand, I have every intention of letting your friends here take all the risk. But if something unpleasant should happen, maybe you could deliver something for me."
Margot felt a small envelope being thrust into her hand. Curiously, she began to lift it toward her goggles.
"No,"
said Mephisto, catching her hand and thrusting it into her own pocket. "Plenty of time for that later, if necessary."
"Why me?" Margot asked.
"Who else?" came the hiss. "That slippery G-man, Pendergast? Or maybe the large economy model of our city's finest standing over there? Or Smithback, the yellow journalist?"
There was a rapid footfall in the darkness. Then Pendergast was back within the dim circle of their flashlights.
"Excellent," he said as Mephisto melted from her side. "Up ahead is a catwalk where I made my own descent. The charge is under the bottleneck should take care of the main reservoir flow to the south. Now we'll set the rest of the charges to block off any spillage from feeders beneath the north end of the park."
The matter-of-fact tone of his voice was more appropriate for a croquet party, Margot thought, than this nightmare stalk, but she was grateful for it. Pendergast grasped the handle of the flamethrower, unclipped the nozzle guard, and pressed the primer a few times.
"I'll go first," he said, "then Mephisto. I trust your instincts. Let me know if you sense anything wrong or out of place." "Being here is out of place," Mephisto said. "Ever since the Wrinklers arrived, this has been shunned ground."
"Margot, you'll be next," Pendergast continued. "Take care of Smith back. Vincent, I'd like you to cover the rear. There might be a conflict."
"Right," the ghost said. "I'd like to help," Margot heard Smith back say softly.
Pendergast looked at him.
"I'm useless without a weapon," the writer explained, his voice unsteady but determined.
"Can you handle a gun?" Pendergast asked.
"Used to shoot skeet with a 16-gauge," Smithback said.
The ghost stifled a laugh. Pendergast pursed his lips a moment, as if calculating something. Then he unslung the other weapon from his shoulder and passed it over.
"This is an M-79. It fires 40-millimeter high-explosive rounds. Be sure you've got a kill zone of at least 100 feet before you use it. The ghost can describe to you how to reload as we go. I expect if action starts, there will be plenty of light for you to see with."
Smithback nodded.
"The thought of a journalist with a grenade launcher makes me very nervous," came DeGosta's voice out of the darkness.
"We'll set the charges, then leave," Pendergast said. "Fire only as a last resort. The sound will bring the entire nest down upon us. Vincent, set the flash unit to strobe and use it at the first sign of trouble. We'll blind them first, then fire. Be sure to remove your goggles first. The flash unit will overload them. We know they hate light, so once they know we're here, let's use it to our advantage."
He turned. "Margot, just how sure are you about the vitamin D?"
100% sure, she answered immediately.
Then she paused.
"Well, 95% anyway."
"I see," the FBI agent replied. "Well, if there's a confrontation, you'd better use your pistol first."
Pendergast took a final look around, then began cautiously leading the group down the ancient tunnel. Margot could see DeGosta leading the journalist forward, gripping his arm tightly. After about 50 yards, Pendergast raised his hand. One by one they all stopped. Very slowly, he brought a warning finger to his lips. Reaching into a pocket of his jacket, he removed a lighter and held it close to the nozzle of the flamethrower. There was a puff, a flash of light, and a low hiss. A tiny blue pilot flame played around the end of the copper nozzle.
"S'mores, anyone?" Mephisto murmured.
Margot breathed through her nose, struggling to stay calm. The air was heavy with the combined reek of methane and ammonia, and overlying them both was a faint, goatish odor she knew only too well.
58. Snow leaned his aching back against the brick wall of the landing. Easing the fins from his feet, he laid them carefully along the wall where the weights and tanks were being placed in neat rows. He thought about removing the rubber duffel at his side, then remembered what the commander had said about not parting with it until the mission was over. The landing felt slimy beneath his neoprene booties. He removed his mouthpiece, wincing at the smell of the ambient air. His eyes stung, and he blinked several times.
"Better get adjusted,"
he thought, taking a hit of oxygen. From this point on, he knew it would be on foot. Around him, the SEALs were removing their masks and tanks, opening waterproof packs, readying gear. Commander Racklin snapped on a flare and jammed it into a crack in the brick wall. It hissed and sputtered quietly, bathing the room in fitful red light.
"Ready your comm sets. Emergency use only on the private frequency. I want noise discipline enforced at all times. Remember, each team has a candyman carrying redundant charges. If for any reason one of the three forward teams is unable to carry out their mission, the other teams will cover."
He took another glance at his waterproof map, then rolled it tight and snugged it into the curve of his knife strap.
"Delta," he said, speaking to Donovan, "you're fail-safe. You hang back here at the rally point, provide loose cover to the rear. If any team fails in its objective, you fill in."
He looked around.
"Beta, take that tunnel. Gamma, the far tunnel. They'll end in vertical shaft ways at about 500 meters. That's where you'll place your charges. We meet back here no later than 23:20 hours. Any later, and we're not leaving."
Racklin looked hard at Snow.
"You all right, darling?"
Snow nodded. The commander nodded.
"Let's go. Beecham, you're with me."
Snow watched the three teams disappear into the darkness, shadows bobbing against glistening walls, their booties squelching in the thick muck. The comset felt awkward and foreign on his head. As the sounds faded away, swallowed by the darkness of the outflow tunnels, he felt a gathering sense of menace. Donovan was exploring the cavern, examining the shorings and aged bricks. In a few minutes, he stepped noiselessly back toward the equipment cache, ghostly in the light of a flare.
"Smells like shit down here," he said at last, squatting down beside Snow.
Snow didn't bother to make the obvious reply.
"Not bad swimming for a sieve,"
the SEAL continued, adjusting his web belt. Apparently, Snow's performance in the tunnels had convinced Donovan it wouldn't be beneath his dignity to speak with him.
"You're the guy that pulled the two bodies out of Cloaca, aren't you?"
"Yeah," Snow replied defensively. He wondered what Donovan had heard.
"Crazy damn job, looking for dead bodies," Donovan laughed.
"No crazier than killing Viet Cong or packing explosives under some poor bastard's hull," Snow thought.
Aloud, he said,
"We don't just look for dead bodies. That day we were actually looking for a cache of heroin somebody thrown off a bridge." "Heroin, huh? Must have been some pretty messed up fish down there for a while."
Snow ventured a laugh, but even to himself it sounded forced and awkward.
"What the hell's the matter with you? Be cool like Donovan."
"I'll bet the cloaca hasn't seen a live fish for 200 years. "Got a point there," Donovan said, heaving himself to his feet again. "Man, I don't envy you. I'd rather do a week of PT than swim 5 minutes in this muck."
Snow saw the SEAL look at his harpoon gun with a smirk.
"You'd best have a real weapon just in case we have to go in."
Donovan rummaged in one of the kit bags and pulled out a machine gun with a cruel-looking metal tube fixed to the underside of its barrel.
"Ever fire an M-16 before?"
he asked. "The tactical guys let us try some on the range during the academy graduation picnic," Snow said. A look of incredulity mixed with amusement crossed Donovan's features.
"Is that right? The academy graduation picnic? And I'll bet your mother made you a sack lunch."
He tossed the rifle towards Snow, then reached into the bag and passed over some magazine pouches.
"There are 30-round clips. They'll empty in less than 2 seconds on full automatic, so keep your trigger finger light. Not exactly new technology, but tried and true."
He passed over another pouch.
"That forward trigger is for the XM-148, the grenade launcher attachment. Here are 2 40-millimeter canister rounds, just in case you get ambitious."
"Donovan?"
Snow had to ask.
"What's Chunk Boy?"
A long, slow grin spread across the SEAL's painted face.
"No harm in telling, I guess." "It's the unlucky stiff who catches high mag duty for the operation."
"High mag duty?"
Snow was as much in the dark as he'd been before.
White magnesium flares? Mandatory issue for all night ops, even stealth runs like this. Stupid-ass regulation, but that's the way it is. They're ultra, ultra bright. Twist off the top to arm the detonator, toss one a safe distance, and you got 500,000 candle power on impact. But they're not too stable, if you know what I mean. All it takes is one bullet in that bag, even something small like a 22, and boom! Chunk boy, if you know what I mean. He chuckled, then wandered off again. Snow shifted position, trying to hold the bag as far from his torso as possible. Except for the fitful sputtering of the flare, there was silence for several minutes. Then Snow heard Donovan's low chuckle again.
Man, take a look at this. Can you believe some crazy bastard's been wandering around here in bare feet?
Putting the rifle aside, Snow stood up and came over for a look. A set of bare footprints tracked through the mud. Fresh, too. The mud around the edges was damp, not dry.
Big mother, Donovan murmured. Must be a size 14 triple E, at least.
He laughed again. Snow stared at the strangely broad footprint, the feeling of menace increasing. As Donovan's laughter subsided, Snow heard a distant rumble.
What was that? He asked.
What?
Donovan asked, kneeling and adjusting his H-harness.
Isn't it too early to set off the charges? Snow asked.
I didn't hear anything.
I did.
Suddenly, Snow's heart was hammering in his ribcage. Donovan listened, but there was only silence.
Chill, sport, he said. You're starting to hear things.
I think we should check it with the patrol leader.
Donovan shook his head.
Yeah, and piss him off good.
He glanced at his watch.
Strict noise discipline, remember? The op site isn't even a click away from here. They'll be back in 10 minutes. Then we can get the hell out of this toilet.
He spat fervently into the stagnant mud. The flare guttered and died, plunging the vault into darkness.
Shit, Donovan muttered.
Snow, hand me another from that ditty bag near your feet.
There was another rumble, which slowly resolved into the faint, muffled staccato of gunfire. It seemed to shiver through the ancient walls, rising and falling like a distant storm. In the dark, Snow could hear Donovan rise quickly to his feet, finger punching the comm set.
Team Alpha, patrol leader, do you read?
He hissed. A mass of static came crackling over the frequency. There was a rolling shudder in the ground.
That was a damn grenade,
Donovan said.
Alpha, Beta, come in!
The ground shuddered again.
Snow, get your weapon.
Snow heard the long rattle of a well-oiled bolt being drawn back.
What a cluster hump this is turning into. Alpha, do you read?
5x5.
Racklin's voice came crackling over the comm set.
We've lost communications with Gamma. Stand by.
Roger that,
Donovan said. There was a brief, tense silence. Then the commander's voice returned.
Delta, Gamma must have run into difficulty setting their charges. Handle the redundancy. We've already set our charges, and we'll check Beta's status.
Aye, aye.
A light snapped on, and Donovan looked at Snow.
Let's move, he said. We'll have to set Gamma's charges.
Twisting the light into his shoulder snap, he set off at a lope, running low, his rifle held perpendicular to his chest. Taking a deep breath, Snow followed him into the tunnel. Glancing down, he noticed footprints in the flickering illumination. More prints here, crossing and crisscrossing in a crazed welter, too numerous to pick out the seal booties of Gamma Team. He swallowed hard. Within minutes, Donovan slowed at what looked like an old siding, surrounded by a mass of pylons.
Shouldn't be much further, he muttered, switching off his light and listening carefully.
Where are they?
Snow heard himself asking. He wasn't surprised when Donovan didn't bother to answer.
We're back at the rally point,
came the voice of Racklin in his comm set.
I repeat, charges successfully set. Going to check on Beta now.
Come on,
Donovan said, moving forward again. Suddenly he stopped.
You smell that?
He whispered. Snow opened his mouth, then closed it again as the stench hit him. He turned away instinctively. It was an overripe, earthy smell, its pungency overwhelming the stink of the drainage tunnel. And there was something else, the strangely sweet smell of a butcher's shop. Donovan shook his head as if to clear it, then tensed to move forward again. At that moment, the comm unit buzzed in Snow's ear. There was a hiss, then Racklin's voice suddenly came through.
Attack! Drop flares!
Snow wondered if he'd heard right. Racklin had spoken with abnormal calmness. Then there was a burst of static from the comm unit and a rattle that sounded like gunfire.
Alpha!
Donovan yelled.
You reading? Over.
It's a Raj,
came Racklin's voice.
We're under attack. Couldn't reach Beta. We're setting their charges now. Beach 'em. There!
There was a whoomp, then a terrific explosion. Emerging from the electric...